The Supreme Court has betrayed democracy. Its members, including Jackson, Kagan, and Sotomayor, have proved themselves inept at reading comprehension. And collectively, the court has shown itself to be corrupt and illegitimate. It must be dissolved. That was a reading of a tweet posted by Keith Olbermann in early 2024. Keith was upset that the Supreme Court had ruled that Colorado could not remove Trump from the presidential ballot. When I saw Keith Olbermann had called for the Supreme Court to be dissolved, I was pretty shocked. I hadn't thought about Keith in a long time, so it got me curious to know what he'd been up to. So I went down a Keith Olbermann rabbit hole, checking out some of the outlandish and incendiary things he's said over the years. So this episode will be a look at some of the more strange Keith Olbermann moments over the years, with a focus on his political rage and how that relates to our toxic polarization. This won't be any comprehensive analysis. It will mainly be just some interesting things that stood out to me as I was checking out his various news items from over the past 20 years. Now, some people will assume that I'm picking on Keith for some sort of political purpose due to me being conservative or pro-Trump or something like that. But no, that's not the case. I wanted to do an episode on Keith because I think he's an example of someone who's been deranged by conflict. I think there are many people out there with different political beliefs who have been deranged by conflict. And I think that's what conflict tends to do to us. Especially, I think, people who already have a good amount of narcissistic traits. In a previous episode, I talked about the polarization of Elon Musk, and I'd name Elon as another person I see as having been deranged by conflict. He's someone who seems to see himself, like I think Keith does, as engaged in a good versus evil fight where anyone on the, quote, other side is horrible and irredeemable. There are a lot of similarities between how Elon and Keith speak. Both are quick to insult and dehumanize. Both speak in certain and exaggerated ways about their opponents. Both engage in confident mind reading about their opponents, claiming to know what's in their hearts, when clearly other explanations can suffice. For example, you can often find Elon claiming to know with certainty that Democrats' more lax approaches to immigration are all about Democrats trying to get votes and retain power. Elon just knows that, you see. To hell with the fact that there are clearly other explanations for the various stances people have. To hell with the need for evidence to prove such a claim. Anyone with, quote, common sense can see how bad these people are. So that kind of thinking goes. And they may not even believe all the things they say, but they might see their deception and exaggeration as the ends justifying the means. So hopefully that helps you see that I'm not focusing on Keith out of some desire to denigrate the, quote, left or for any specific political reason. I also don't do this to insult or demean Keith as a person. I actually feel bad for him, just as I feel a bit sorry for Elon Musk. It can't be a pleasant way to go through life. But then again, maybe it does seem exciting to them as they've convinced themselves they are the hero in their own exciting good versus evil story. They might see themselves as on some sort of hero's journey in a Lord of the Rings kind of world surrounded by villains. It might be fun in the same way a mentally ill delusion can be fun. But I think really it's a tragic way to experience the world, one that separates them from the people around them, one that amplifies their narcissism and prevents connection in all sorts of ways, not just with people on the, quote, other side, but with people they may actually have a lot in common with. I'm reminded of an Arthur Brooks quote, which he wrote in his book, Love Your Enemies. If you have contempt for them, more and more people will become them. I think that sums up the problem with this kind of contemptuous, warlike mentality. It makes people more miserable, more hateful, less empathetic of the people around them, and that will play out in many areas of their personal lives. I think what's happened to Elon and Keith is what has happened to many people around us. It's just the kind of thinking that many of us fall prey to when we're in conflict. even as few of us have big national audiences from which to spew our contempt. The truth is that this is just what serious conflict can do to us. And then on top of that, we've got social media, which maybe is the core cause at the heart of a lot of this, the way that social media makes the conflict more visceral. All the fighting that Elon and Keith have done online makes it easier for them to feel that they're entrenched in a good versus evil battle, surrounded by evil enemies on all sides. And I think some people might feel like I'm picking on someone who is clearly mentally unwell. You can find a lot of people saying that Keith is unwell, even some of his political opponents. And I think that's true, but I also don't find his warlike mentality as much different from what many people on the left and right think and say these days about their perceived enemies. I don't find him any more mentally unwell than I do Elon Musk, for example. The simple fact is that this is what many people are like these days, even as some people who feel these ways perhaps hold in their anger and emotions and insults more than Keith and Elon do. I'd also like to say, if you're someone in the conservative pro-Trump camp, hopefully you don't watch this with only the intent of saying, yeah, Keith's crazy. I hope you consider how these kinds of approaches are present on the right. For example, you can find Elon saying similar outlandish, hateful things, as I said. You can also find Trump himself saying such things often. Now, obviously, you believe what you believe, but I hope you are able to see that there is plenty on the Republican side to agitate and disturb people in these areas, and to make people think these guys are out of their minds, in the same way that many people think Oberman is out of his mind. Having said that, I also know the defense from the Republican side would go something like, but Trump and Elon and others are just responding to such things on the left. That is why they are like that. And I myself even had a previous episode trying to get liberal and anti-Trump people to have more cognitive empathy for Trump voters and even for Trump himself in terms of seeing the many overly pessimistic and insulting things that are thrown their way from liberals. I realize that we all make excuses for these things on both sides. That is the nature of conflict. We justify why it's okay when we or our side does these kinds of things. But that's the problem. We all just keep justifying these things and going, well, what about this stuff over here on the other side? And it all just keeps getting worse. I just hope a lot of people watching this, no matter their political beliefs, agree that these things are problems, no matter who does it. If you like the themes in this video, please consider checking out one of my books on polarization, which you can learn about at american-anger.com, or sign up for my Substack, which you can find at diffusingamericananger.substack.com. I'm actually working on these things full-time these days, so I appreciate any paid subscriptions or other financial support you can send my way. You can send me money via my Buy Me a Coffee page, which is at buymeacoffee.com/Zach Elwood, ZACHELWOOD. As we go through this episode, one thing I'd like you to think about is, do you think Keith has helped create the very things he's upset by? Do you think his 2 decades of insulting and dehumanizing his political opponents have been a factor in making similar behaviors on the right more likely? I certainly do.
The man who sees absolutes where all other men see nuances and shades of meaning is either a prophet or a quack.
Thank you for that observation, Keith. I agree. So let's go back to Keith's statement about the Supreme Court. In March of 2024, after the unanimous ruling by the Supreme Court that said Colorado couldn't remove Trump from the presidential ballot, Olbermann wrote his post on Twitter about wanting to dissolve the Supreme Court. Now, keep in mind that was unanimous. Keith is basically saying that there was no legitimate reason why the entire Supreme Court, including the ones seen as liberal-leaning, would vote that way. He allowed no room for disagreement. And that's the wild thing about what polarization does to us. It makes us highly certain, highly team-based in how we think about the world. Does Keith really believe there were no solid reasons for all the judges to vote the same way? Or does his rage and frustration just lead him to speak in extreme and superlative ways? I don't pretend to know, but either way, it's what we see a lot more of from people when they're highly emotional and in conflict. And this tweet thread of Olbermann's is just a microcosm of how people on both sides rile each other up on social media and serve as the basis for each other's rage. There's Gunther Eagleman, a right-wing account known for trolling and insulting people. Seen that one a lot. He wrote Crymore90, referring to the unanimous ruling of nine justices. Keith responds, "Those aren't tears, fascist. They're urine. I'm sure you enjoy being bathed in it." So yeah, just a lot of maturity in that thread. Let's go to this show, The Young Turks. They have a video called Sink Reacts to Keith Olbermann's Idiotic Post. And this is a politically progressive show, if you're not familiar with it.
Must be dissolved. So there you have Keith Olbermann arguing that a major part of our system of checks and balances should absolutely be dissolved because they had a unanimous decision that he didn't like. Insanity.
Yeah, so I think he's lost his mind.
Totally.
Egregious. Okay, and I have that conversation. But in this case, they were unanimous for a reason, because no one adjudicated Trump to be an insurrectionist other than random Democrats in two or three states. That's not how the process works. That's not how the process should work. But guys like Olbermann, who are blue MAGA, have lost their minds. That's why you call them blue MAGA, right? Red MAGA thinks Trump won the 2020 election, et cetera. So they lost their minds in that way. It detached from objective reality. And blue MAGA is just as detached.
Poll after poll after poll. At some point, you have to maybe accept reality. And that's part of the problem, Cenk. We have a growing group of people on both sides who just do not want to accept reality. And that makes everything so much more difficult. And what drives me insane is that the media has become super partisan. So you either watch left-wing media or right-wing media, and audiences have become so accustomed to hearing one ideological side that once they get any information that dispels preconceived notions, you know, they don't react well to it. And I think that's part of the problem. And so we...
Yeah, I just wanted to play some of that. I thought they did a good job trying to argue, showcase what was going wrong there. And this was actually the second time, at least the second time that I know of, that Keith has called for dissolving the Supreme Court. Another time was in 2022, in response to the court's ruling overturning New York's concealed carry restrictions. And there he said, "It has become necessary to dissolve the Supreme Court of the United States. The first step is for a state, the court," he always puts court in quotes as if it's not a real court. "The first step is for a state the court has now forced guns upon to ignore this ruling." Great, you're a court. Why and how do you think you can enforce your rulings? Hashtag ignore the court. The following is from a Fox News article about that in 2022. "Olbermann's strong rhetoric brought intense mockery from conservatives, with online critics saying he sounded unhinged and also taking exception to his call for lower courts to ignore the ruling." "Sounds kind of insurrection-y," Keith, Substack writer Jim Tretcher quipped. So over the last few years, Keith's audience has dwindled a lot. He now seems to reach some tens of thousands of people on his YouTube channel and other social media, whereas he used to reach millions years ago when he was on primetime TV. To give you a sense of the kind of incendiary stuff Keith shares, here's one clip from October of 2024.
"And Trump and New York Knicks, Rangers, and Madison Square Garden owner James Dolan have agreed to rent Trump Madison Square Garden for a rally later this month at which they hope to draw 20,000 Trump supporters. If this sounds vaguely familiar, it should. In February 1939, the Nazis also rallied at Madison Square Garden and drew 20,000. The problem for the Nazis was, and it might be the problem for Trump and especially this idiot Dolan, that in addition to the 20,000 Nazis inside Madison Square Garden, there were 100,000 anti-Nazis outside Madison Square Garden. We'll see you there October 27th.
In the copy for that post, he refers to the rally as a Trump-Nazi rally. Almost seemed too like he was trying to encourage people to go out and counter-protest there in a subtle kind of way. But Keith often compares Trump to Hitler and his supporters to Nazis. Here's one from November of 2024 after Trump's election, in which he tells Hispanic Trump voters that Trump will come after them eventually, even if they're legal citizens.
He will deport people from the same place you or your folks are from. He will deport people who have the same names you do. He will deport your relatives and friends. And when he runs out, he will change the laws and he will deport you and your parents and your children.
He goes on to say this about Stephen Miller, who is Trump's immigration advisor.
Originates from all of that. So he hates Hispanics exactly the way Hitler hated Jews. And Trump, who hates them, but less fervently, because hating them takes time away from talking about himself. He listens to Stephen Miller, and he hears more votes. And not only does he get elected president while his brains are draining out his ears like a runny yeast infection, but the very people he is going to torture and deport vote for him.
After Trump's election, Keith could be found saying that the Russians had stolen the election, which was the same thing he did in 2016. This is from a YouTube video from November 2024.
Russia has committed an act of war against this nation and our form of government. We were attacked last night, as certainly as if they came across the borders, or as if they had bombed polling stations, 40 or more polling stations, 32 Russian origin bomb threats just in Fulton County, Georgia alone. And what are you going to do about it, President Biden? What are you going to do about it, Merrick Garland? Or are you, Merrick Garland, in another coma?
After Trump's election in 2016, Keith said the following.
We are at war with Russia. Or perhaps more correctly, we have lost a war with Russia without a battle. We are no longer a sovereign nation. We are no longer a democracy. We are no longer a free people. We are the victims of a bloodless coup. So far, a bloodless coup engineered by Russia with, at best, the traitorous indifference of the Republican Party and Donald John Trump, a man who, to borrow a phrase from another December long ago, will live in infamy.
He said he was certain that Russia had gotten Trump elected. The following's from the video he made that around that same time.
One thing to read that your country's intelligence services believe that government-backed attackers tried to influence the outcome of the presidential election, or that government-backed attackers tried to access the voter registration rolls of at least 20 states. But let me assure you, it is quite another thing to see the red stripe across the screen of your laptop put there as warning by people who are anything but amateurs in this field, suggesting that those government-backed attackers are now targeting you. That protected...
The description for that on the GQ Facebook site where that video was says, Keith Olbermann explains why he's 100% sure the Russian government put Donald J. Trump in the White House. Now, there's no conclusive evidence that Russia's actions affected the outcome of the 2016 election or the 2024 election. There's no evidence, for example, that Russians succeeded in hacking voting machines or changing votes. So Keith's extreme certainty here seems misplaced, to say the least, as it often seems to be. Now, I write about liberal side election distrust in my book, Diffusing American Anger, and why that's a bad thing, and even something that made conservative side election distrust more likely. Many people think that the Russian social media misinformation played a role in shifting the election, but there's no evidence that it shifted things. A 2023 paper that looked into this was titled Exposure to the Russian Internet Research Agency Foreign Influence Campaign on Twitter in the 2016 U.S. Election and Its Relationship to Attitudes and Voting Behavior. They concluded, we find no evidence of a meaningful relationship between exposure to the Russian Foreign Influence Campaign and changes in attitudes, polarization, or voting behavior. In a New Yorker article about the idea that Russia influenced us, Brendan Nyhan, a professor of public policy, argued that though the number of Russian-sponsored messages during the 2016 campaign might sound alarmingly large, the universe of information that most voters are exposed to is so vast that the impact of fake news and other malicious online misinformation is diluted. He noted, Twitter, for instance, reported that Russian bots tweeted 2.1 million times before the election, certainly a worrisome number, but these represented only 1% of all election-related tweets and 0.5% of views of election-related tweets. He concluded, it's hard to change people's minds. Now, some people may disagree, but the point is that there are knowledgeable people who do not think Russia succeeded at having a significant impact on the 2016 election. And that fact shows that highly certain takes that they did are opinions and are not conclusive. Also, as I talk about in my book, Diffusing American Anger, it could be that Russia's primary goal was simply to make us distrust elections as a way to increase animosity and destabilize us. It would be difficult for Russia to actually impact our election. It's a lot easier to get a country to distrust their elections by making it obvious you've tried to manipulate the election. So when we allow our animosity and distrust to lead us to too easily believe and spread the election was rigged type ideas, as Keith has done, we might be basically doing exactly what Russia hoped we would do. And our election distrust will in turn trigger more election distrust. Our opponents will be more likely to think, well, they did it too, so you can't judge us for that. I won't spend a lot of time in this video debunking Keith's incendiary and highly certain claims, as there are so many of them, but I thought this was a good spot to show just one example of how, for many of Keith's incendiary takes, emotion and unreasonable certainty seem to play a big role. Back in 2017, Keith also said that he was certain that the Trump campaign had colluded with Russia. The title of this video, which got more than 387,000 views on YouTube, was Case Closed, Collusion Has Been Proven.
Four titanic facts have now emerged. Their importance cannot be overstated. The conclusion they lead to cannot be avoided. We have all been right all this time. The essence of the conspiracy case against Donald Trump, his presidential campaign, his presidential administration, and the government of Russia has, for all intents and purposes, been proven.
So I won't play all that or analyze it all, but long story short, no, there is not conclusive evidence that Trump colluded with Russia. If you think that they did, then at the very least, you might consider that there are many smart and anti-Trump people knowledgeable about such things who do not believe there's good evidence for that. That at least helps show that high certainty there is wrong. But we are surrounded by people like Keith Olbermann on the left and the right who speak with high certainty about all sorts of things related to our divides. When you hear highly certain statements about things that someone can't be certain about, that it seems unlikely they could be certain about, and that other knowledgeable people have different takes on, and when you hear such certain takes frequently from someone, that's a good reason to be highly skeptical of that person as a source of information. Certainty is the mind killer. Certainty can be the country killer. In 2020, Keith said that Trump's enablers and supporters must be, quote, removed from society.
Can be and must be expunged. The terrorist Trump must be defeated, and then he and his enablers and his supporters and his collaborators and the Mike Lees and the William Barrs and the Sean Hannitys and the Mike Pences and the Rudy Giulianis and the Kyle Rittenhouses and the Amy Coney Barretts must be prosecuted and convicted and removed from our society while we try to rebuild it.
As you'd expect, these kinds of things from Keith get a lot of attention from conservative news outlets. That video I just played was posted on the Daily Caller Facebook account and had 400,000 views. This is the kind of stuff that convinces Republicans of how evil their opponents are. We can see Keith as being part of that self-reinforcing conflict spiral. In 2024, mid-2024, Keith said he wanted to disband the St. Louis Cardinals baseball team and demolish their stadium. Here's someone talking about that.
This segment could last all week, given the plethora of vile comments Mr. Olbermann has made over the years, but we'll start with the most recent. Following the assassination attempt of President Donald Trump, several Major League Baseball players celebrated home runs by holding a fist in the air and a hand over their ear. This prompted quintessentially unhinged responses from former sports commentator Keith Olbermann, who first posted, quote, a reminder that there is still no evidence Trump was hit by a bullet and still lots of evidence he is lying about it, unquote. This was followed by a call to disband the entire St. Louis franchise as well as to destroy its ballpark. He goes, quote, attention MLB, ban these guys from baseball for life, confiscate the Cardinals franchise and implode the stadium. Implode the stadium. Are you serious? And you wonder why gunshots are being fired at a former president? He continues, quote, Cardinals equal Trump Nazis, stick to sports, F the St. Louis Cardinals, America has had enough of this blank, unquote. I'll tell you what America has had enough of, the hateful and ignorant drivel which spews from your mouth.
Kind of wild stuff there. That was another doozy. Here we can see another aspect of what conflict does to people. It makes us interpret things in the worst possible way. So apparently, I'm not really sure what the deal was with those hand gestures, but I read another analysis saying that it was related to something else is why they use those hand gestures. It was apparently some common thing they do. I don't really know. But the point is that Keith, I don't think, knew either. He just jumped to the worst possible interpretation was that they were all, Cardinals were all extremely pro-Trump or something. But we can see this kind of thing all around us, people filtering for the worst case interpretation possible and then somehow becoming very certain of that worst case interpretation. Another way to think about this is there's the thing called negativity bias, which is our tendency to focus on negative things, which is, I think, as Travis Monteleone has written about, who writes about polarization, he puts polarization down to being at heart about negativity bias, our tendency to continually filter for negative things and our views of the other side get worse and views of things happening around us get more and more pessimistic and so on. And I think he's right there, fundamentally, at a core level. It is about our negativity bias. And honestly, if I was more paranoid, if I was as paranoid as Keith Olbermann, I might start thinking that his behavior was part of a plot to turn people against liberals. Maybe Russia has incriminating dirt on Keith and they're forcing Keith to say these things to increase support for Trump. To hell with maybe, I think I'm actually certain of it. So you heard it here first. I'm 100% certain Keith Olbermann is a Russian asset. To be clear, I'm kidding there. That's a joke. So in November of 2024, Ohio State tweeted, congratulations to Vice President-elect J.D. Vance, an alumnus of the Ohio State University and native Ohioan. This led Keith to say, wasn't before, is now. Shit school. And this was reminiscent of him getting in a fight with another school back in 2015. He had a penchant for mocking Penn State students and family members. This was apparently caused by him being upset with the school for their conduct during the Sandusky scandal. He told a Penn State student's mother that Penn State was, quote, pitiful. He also told someone, again, get your money back. You didn't learn how to read. PSU students are pitiful because they're PSU students, period. This kind of really petty interaction from Keith over the years, even for non-political stuff, really just shows how how far he's degraded himself. In 2019, he got in some hot water for his with his then employer ESPN for saying some really harsh, aggressive things about a hunter. A news article featured a hunter who had shot an all-white turkey, and Keith tweeted, "It be rare and beautiful, so me should kill it. This pea-brained scumbag identifies himself as Hunter Waltman, and we should do our best to make sure the rest of his life is a living hell." And that Keith later apologized for that. I think with ESPN's prompting, ESPN said in a statement, "We have spoken to him about not making personal attacks." So much of Keith's life seems to revolve around attacking people on Twitter. Now, it does make you wonder how much social media has been a negative influence in his and other people's lives. Pre-social media, how would Keith and Elon and others who do similar things online have spent their time? Where would they have gotten a similar fix in terms of fighting with people directly like this? I think at the heart of these things is how conflict affects us, but social media makes the conflict more direct and visceral. It puts us in the middle of it. It allows us to strike out when we're angry, and then that will be seen by others who will attack us, and so on and so on. I do see the internet as a conflict amplifying machine, a place that aids in the creation and distribution of insults and threats. And there are a lot of people who think that. If you'd like to learn more about that, check out this piece of mine on the ways that internet communication can derange and divide us. That's on my Substack at diffusingamericananger.substack.com. And there are a lot of people who have talked about Keith's turn for the worse, including progressive liberal activists. I'll play a little bit from Kyle Kulinski's YouTube episode he did on this. His show is called Secular Talk.
All right, guys, this is just embarrassing, man. This is just humiliating. So you all know Keith Olbermann. Look, at one time he was a legend, right? He was on MSNBC during the Bush era. He was one of the sole voices really going after Bush and going after the illegal war in Iraq. And he sounded like just this legendary crusading character standing up for the right thing, being anti-war at a time when nobody on TV was anti-war. Phil Donahue was anti-war over on MSNBC, and they fired him early on. It took Keith Olbermann years later to come up and start making the same arguments, and he had a decent following at the time. He got some good numbers, so they allowed it to continue, right? But one of the things you always heard, whispers behind the scenes, is that Keith Olbermann is fucking crazy, that he's just a total nutcase. And everybody.
Yeah, long story short, he basically describes Keith's fall from grace of being really respected to tweeting really idiotic things about Trump and stuff. So then he examined the purpose of his video was to examine a specific thing that Keith had done, where what Kyle called a new low. Keith was trying to defend Biden after Biden's really horrible debate performance in last July, I think.
So look, let me show you this right here. Here's the tweet. Today's YouGov CBS poll, should Biden stay in the race? Yes, 55% to 45%. Should Trump stay in the race? No, 54% to 46%. That says it all. Any effing questions? Now, if you just read that, you think, oh, okay, fair enough, decent point. Just wait for it. Wait for the specifics. So, should Biden be the nominee? That question was of Democratic registered voters. Should Trump be running for president? That's of all registered voters. So you see how he rigged the game? As it says here, and by the way, I don't even think he rigged the game. I just think he was breezing through this stuff and thought he found a gotcha and he tweeted it without actually really looking too closely at what he was posting. Characterizing the conclusions as yes, Biden should, and no, Trump should not, the former Fox Sports host wrote, that says it all, any effing questions? But many users pointed out that the former Current TV host was not showing two sides of the...
Okay, yeah, I think you get the idea. He was comparing two unlike surveys, basically. But this was interesting, too, for a very mature thing that Kyle did. It would have been easy for Kyle to ascribe Keith's behavior to very malicious motives that, for example, Keith was purposefully posting something untrue. But Kyle maturely does not do that. He sees that it's probably more likely that Keith's mind is just rattled, that Keith is acting too quickly, posting too quickly, is being highly emotional. So that's nice of Kyle to do that. I think that's something we rarely do for people, especially if there are political opponents. In this case, he probably was more a little bit more nice to Keith because they were on the quotes same side. And we can see these same kinds of things, by the way, that Keith's doing from Elon Musk, who often posts and shares incendiary things. And then his own platform's community notes will often correct him. And it's obvious he just went off half-cocked about something very emotionally. And then Elon also just leaves those posts up. He doesn't seem to care that they were false or that maybe he should take them down. Just as Keith doesn't seem to care about the many untrue things that he leaves littered around the internet for people to see. I just think anger and emotions are, you know, a hell of a drug. Fear and anger are the mind killers. They're contagious mind killers too. They spread to other people. If you're curious for more about that on Elon's part, watch my previous episode about Elon's polarization. It's much shorter than this one. It's pretty short. It's based on an op-ed I wrote. And you can find a bunch of conservatives posting videos and posts about their interactions with Keith, where Keith has insulted them in pretty vicious ways. I'll play this one from this guy. I don't know who this guy is. Clay Travis or something like that.
So I wonder, on some level, does Keith Olbermann have anybody who cares about him in his life? I don't think he's married. I don't think he has any kids. He sits around on his phone, constantly sending out all sorts of insane things every single day, to the point where I think if you read his Twitter feed, it's quite clear that he is mentally deranged. So I really want him to get help. And I think this is the case for a lot of people. Social media is not good for people with any kind of mental instability. And I think it makes mental instability worse because it is an emotional medium. And I am convinced that the reason why the country has gone so haywire over the last 8 or 9 years is directly connected to social media and the ability of all of this to be in our pockets, constantly playing on our psyche all day long. To the point where I just don't think it's healthy to spend as much time on social media, but particularly for people who have already depressive tendencies, manic depressive tendencies, issues with bipolar, mental illness, suicidal ideation. I think this is the most toxic thing that could exist for those people.
Yeah, and obviously lots of people agree with that. I agree with that. And it says a lot. Says a lot about Keith that even many of the people he's gotten in fights with seem to feel really bad. And Keith has been fired from a lot of places. He was fired from Current TV in 2012 after only being there a year. Current TV was a short-lived TV station aimed at becoming like the Fox News of the left. At least that was my understanding of it. Reading from Keith's Wikipedia, Olbermann was fired from Current TV on March 30, 2012. In a statement from Current TV, they stated that Current was founded on the values of respect, openness, collegiality, and loyalty to our viewers. Unfortunately, these values are no longer reflected in our relationship with Keith Olbermann, and we have ended it. Keith Olbermann released his own statement apologizing for the failure of Current TV and that the claims against me implied in Current statement are untrue and will be proved so in the legal actions I will be filing against them presently. So according to Politico, Olbermann's professional reputation suffered greatly as a result of that dispute with Current. Apparently, despite active shopping with other networks for offers, Olbermann was unable to find an outlet interested in hiring him. So that was part of the dispute, claiming that they had hurt his chances of getting hired, his employment chances. In 2011, Salon ran an article by Neil Stanage about Keith's departure, from his countdown show on MSNBC. The article emphasized an important point, and one that I often emphasize in my work on polarization, that we can largely agree with someone in terms of stances while thinking their approach is very, very bad. In my op-ed I got published about Elon Musk in The Hill, that's a point that I focused on, that one should be able to largely agree with Elon while seeing his approach to conflict is very bad, unhelpful, and even as helping create the pushback one is working against. But we too often conflate people's stances with how they view and speak about their adversaries. We conflate their political beliefs with their approaches to conflict. Neil wrote, "I cannot imagine I am the only viewer who is basically simpatico with Olbermann's worldview, but who had come to find him and his show utterly insufferable. The glibness, the pomposity, the narcissism, all these foibles had of late reached gut-wrenching proportions." He went on to write, "There was a bigger problem too. Olbermann rose to prominence in large part through attacking other media figures, most notably Bill O'Reilly, for both their gloating self-regard and their rhetorical recklessness. Olbermann's claim to the moral high ground here was strictly relative. This is a man, after all, who once reported an allegation that Paris Hilton had been punched in the face under the tagline, 'A slut and battery.' Hilarious, no? Later silliness, the risible condemnation of then-senator-elect Scott Brown as, quote, an irresponsible, homophobic, racist, reactionary, ex-nude model, tea-bagging supporter of violence, end quote, only strengthened the impression that Olbermann had morphed into a mirror image of those he so often attacked." And there were several pieces around that time that pointed out Keith was had become like the people that he battled with. A 2011 piece in Variety said, "While it was initially amusing watching Olbermann playfully try to nudge O'Reilly off the deep end, there's a significant difference between that and self-indulgently using his forum as a pulpit to bash enemies, which actually makes him more like his Fox counterpart than he would care to admit." So that thing Keith said about Scott Brown that was just mentioned, that's one of the more interesting and crazy highlights of Keith's career. It made a big splash. He was mocked even by many on the left for this. And I think that was kind of the moment when Keith really began going downhill, like big time. And that event happened in January of 2010. Now, interestingly, 2010 also happened to be the time when many people were starting to spend a lot more time on their mobile phones. Social media apps were just getting really popular around that time. 2009 was the year that John Haidt and others were pointing out that that year was significant in terms of social media apps because Facebook and Twitter had changed their algorithms to make posts, especially highly emotional posts, spread more virally. And out of curiosity, I looked up the first tweets that Keith made on Twitter. And it looked like he, unless he erased some, it looked like he started in April of 2010. As you can see, if you're looking at on video, he tweeted a lot from the very beginning. But the so the Scott Brown thing that I'm going to examine in a second preceded that a little bit just by a few months from when he apparently started tweeting. And to be clear, I'm not saying that I think Keith's conduct can be traced entirely to social media, as clearly he's been doing this kind of stuff for a while. But I do think it's at least possible that the emotional environment that social media created around that time, making it easier for Keith and others to see all these messages from all across the country, to see all these messages and thoughts that made them angrier and that they could then focus on more in their shows and such. I think it's possible all that environment contributed to Keith becoming even more polarized and unreasonable than he was. So yeah, looking back at those first tweets is kind of interesting because, I mean, I looked at the ones on for April 11th, like his second day of tweeting, basically, and he had 70 tweets. And many of them were of the insulting variety. He just seemed to like, you know, randomly replying to random people and lashing out at them. He really liked the engagement that social media provided, clearly. But if your instinct is to lash out at people often, as it's clear Keith's is, and if that in turn provokes people into often lashing back out at you, I think it's easy to see how that creates a pretty maddening experience. I think we've all experienced a little bit of that. But I think it's easy to see how these things can really amplify people's existing narcissism and us versus them mindsets and warlike instincts and such. So anyway, on to this Scott Brown thing. So in 2010, before the Massachusetts special election, Keith ran this segment about Republican candidate Scott Brown. And as a reminder, this was when Obama was president. Obama was elected 2 years before in 2008. It was also at the time when the Tea Party had become a thing, and Keith often lashed out at the Tea Party movement as being motivated largely by racism. So I'll play, I think this is worth playing Keith's clip in the entirety, or at least the most pertinent part about Scott Brown.
Here's the second of tonight's quick comments. Lost in the angst about Obama and Coakley is the little recognized real headline of this vote. You have heard Scott Brown speculating, talking out of his bare bottom, about whether or not the president of the United States was born out of wedlock. You have heard Scott Brown respond to the shout from his supporter that they should stick a curling iron into Ms. Coakley's rectum with the answer, "We can do this." You may not have heard Scott Brown support a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage or describing two women having a child as being, quote, just not normal. You may not have heard Scott Brown associating himself with the Tea Party movement, perhaps the saddest collection of people who don't want to admit why they really hate, since the racists of the South in the 60s insisted they were really just concerned about states' rights. You may not have heard Scott Brown voting against funding paid leaves of absence for Massachusetts Red Cross workers who had gone to New York to help after 9/11. In short, in Scott Brown, we have an irresponsible, homophobic, racist, reactionary, ex-new model, teabagging supporter of violence against women and against politicians with whom he disagrees. In any other time in our history, this man would have been laughed off the stage as an unqualified and a disaster in the making by the most conservative of conservatives. Instead, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts is close to sending this bad joke to the Senate of the United States.
There's a lot to say about that, and more on that in a little bit, but long story short, Keith was really reaching for some unfair and extremely worst-case interpretations of many things there about Scott Brown, but more on that in a moment. But it was an egregious moment that led to many in the business, even on the left, criticizing Keith. Joe Scarborough, his colleague at MSNBC, called the comments reckless and sad. Various pundits criticized him. In March, Jon Stewart talked about this. He played Keith's segment and then talked about what Keith had missed. So I think it's worth including a good chunk of Jon Stewart's points as they help us see just how bad and biased Keith was behaving at that time.
Obviously, with the stakes so high, in this week's Massachusetts Senate race, emotions ran hot on both sides of the contest, peaking on election eve.
In Scott Brown, we have an irresponsible, homophobic, racist, reactionary, ex-new model, teabagging supporter of violence against women and against politicians with whom he disagrees.
I understand you may disagree somewhat with Senator Brown, but two things. A Massachusetts Republican is still considered like a gay Democrat in other parts of the country. So, and B, I think that's the harshest description of anyone I've ever heard uttered on MSNBC. But all right, Keith, I understand it's emotional. You probably give it a day. You'll see you went too far.
I need to apologize for comments made here last night about the Republican candidate.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a little much. It's an emotional night.
I'm sorry. I left out the word sexist.
See, you're looking to plant your flag on this one. All right. Testify.
I said Mr. Brown was an ex-nude model, specifically in the June 1982 issue of Cosmopolitan magazine.
Wow. The focus, soft. The trail, happy. Point Olbermann, Next.
I said Mr. Brown was irresponsible. Specifically, he swore at a hall full of high school students in 2007.
Or, as they remember it, the best assembly ever. Okay, for those charges, I mean, I swear in front of an audience full of high school students every night. So now let's get into some of the harder charges.
I said Mr. Brown was sexist. Specifically, 9 years ago, he said a woman Massachusetts state senator had, quote, alleged family responsibilities.
That's it? 9 years ago, he said something I'm not even sure I understand? You think that's... Now here's the capper, and perhaps the most damning allegation for a man who has two daughters that he clearly seems to love, that he supports violence against women.
Specifically this past Sunday, when a man at a Brown rally shouted they should, quote, shove a curling iron up Martha Coakley's butt, Brown responded by answering, we can do this. Or, if that remark was unconnected to the shout, he never refuted, condemned, nor disassociated himself from the call to violence and even sexual assault.
Come on! If I had to refute or disassociate myself from every offensive statement some jackass in my audience shouted out, I'd never get my show on the air!
Go f*** yourself, Jew boy!
We can do this!
I won't play all of this, but you get the idea. Alperman was, as he often does, really exaggerating the bad things one might be able to say about Scott Brown. I'll cut forward a little farther into John Stewart's segment.
But now, you're just kind of calling people names. To wit, you said this of Joseph Isidore Lieberman, Democrat, Connecticut, a senatorial prostitute of Roger Ailes, fat ass. Chris Wallace, a monkey posing as a newscaster. Rush Limbaugh, a big bag of mashed up jackass. And of Michelle Malkin, you said, a mindless, morally bankrupt, knee-jerk, fascistic, mashed-up bag of meat with lipstick on it, end quote. That, my fine feather friend, sounds a lot more like violence against women than anything Scott Brown ever said.
So later that year, in 2010, John Stewart held his D.C. rally, which was called the Rally to Restore Sanity and or Fear. This rally was aimed at reducing toxic polarization, at trying to help people see that people like Bill O'Reilly and Olbermann, outlets like Fox News and MSNBC, were polarizing us and making us see the worst in each other. Regardless of the implementation, what one thought about how the rally played out, one should really appreciate the attempt by John Stewart to work on that problem. I think John was focused on the right thing and focused on it early. And sadly, way too few people heard the message. To many people then, just as today, when they're told this media environment is amplifying fear and discord, we need to do something, most people just have the reaction, well, yeah, the other side's media is horrible. I agree, they need to be stopped. There's very little actual contemplation of how there's a lot of blame to go around for these things, which I think you can examine and embrace that there's plenty of blame to go around, even if you think the other side is much worse. I think it's about seeing the ways that these things reinforce themselves. So at John Stewart's DC rally, they played a clip of media from people on the left and right that they saw as toxic. And that clip included a good chunk of Keith Olbermann's work. So this prominent feature of Keith led to him suspending his Worst Person in the World segment on his Countdown show in November of 2010 in the interest of turning down the volume of hate and anger. But he defended the content of his show by claiming that MSNBC, which hosted Countdown at that time, differed from Fox News in that, quote, sticking up for the powerless is not the moral equivalent of sticking up for the powerful, end quote. But of course, this is how everyone justifies contemptuous rhetoric in any conflict. The other side is worse, so it's not the same as when I do it. There is a fundamental way that conflict makes us into hypocrites. The political philosopher Robert Talese has a good segment in his book, Sustaining Democracy, about how conflict can make us into hypocrites. And I recommend Talese's book. I think it's one of the better books on polarization. And so a lot of these things have a self-reinforcing aspect. When someone like Keith behaves contemptuously, they'll understandably be seen as hypocritical by their political opponents, which will increase their opponent's rage, and those people will be more likely to engage in contemptuous and hypocritical actions, which will increase people like Keith's rage, and so on and so on. So one kind of interesting detail is that Keith brought back his worst person in the world segment only 3 weeks after he said he'd get rid of it based on that criticism at that Jon Stewart rally.
Two story tonight. Tonight's worst persons in the world. The bronze to Greg Howard, seventh grade social.
Keith pretty quickly determined that trying to reduce toxicity wasn't really something he was very much on board with. But what was that segment? This worst person in the world segment that he had. It was on his countdown show on MSNBC. It featured a variety of political opponents that Keith didn't like. Bill O'Reilly was often mentioned. Sometimes he was picked as the worst person multiple times in the same segment. And it sometimes featured random citizens doing stupid and baffling things. It had a humorous flair to it often. But I think the choice of that title for that segment really says a lot about Keith and what he's, you know, the way he views the world. It's just such a maximally polarizing and conflict amplifying choice. So I was digging into the origins of that segment title, and I got Keith's book, which was also called, one of his books was The Worst Person in the World, came out in 2006. And in that book, he claims it was meant to be humorous. He references the comedy duo Bob and Ray having a bit that was called Worst People in the World. And so he kind of highlighted at the very beginning of that book the humorous historical nature of that, tied it into this comedy stuff. But it read to me as just kind of cover as making excuses for Keith's very highly angry way of viewing all disagreements. I think he truly just wants to rouse righteous judgment. That's what he sees his role as being. It just says a lot to choose a title like that. It's just, you know, can you imagine if that was something Bill O'Reilly did that directly insulting and extreme to call these people the worst people in the world every show. Another interesting little trivia detail there is that Keith got the idea to do that segment initially in response to a critic harshly criticizing Tucker Carlson, who at that time was a colleague of Keith's at MSNBC. So yeah, the worst person in the world segment of Keith's started out due to a desire to defend Tucker Carlson, which I thought was a little interesting tidbit in terms of how things have changed and polarized in the years between then and now. So during G.W. Bush's term, Keith got a lot of attention for his hate directed at Bush, his judgment of Bush. One famous incident involved him telling Bush to shut the hell up, and I'll play this clip here.
Mr. President, he was asked, you haven't been golfing in recent years. Is that related to Iraq? Yes, began perhaps the most startling reply of this nightmarish blight on our lives as Americans, on our history. It really is. I don't want some mom whose son may have recently died to see the commander-in-chief playing golf. I feel I owe it to the families to be in solidarity as best as I can with them. And I think playing golf during a war just sends the wrong signal. Golf, sir. Golf sends the wrong signal to the grieving families of our men and women butchered in Iraq. Do you think these families, Mr. Bush, their lives blighted forever, care about you playing golf? Do you think, sir, they care about you? You, Mr. Bush, you who let their sons and daughters be killed? Sir, to show your solidarity with them, you gave up golf? Sir, to show your solidarity with them, you didn't give up your pursuit of this insurance scam, profiteering, morally and financially bankrupting war. Sir, to show your solidarity with them, you didn't even give up talking about Iraq, a subject about which you have incessantly proved without pause or backwards glance that you may literally be the least informed person in the world.
And sir, if you have any hopes that next January 20th will not be celebrated as a day of soul-wrenching, heartfelt thanksgiving because your faithless stewardship of this presidency will have finally come to a merciful end, this last piece of advice. When somebody asks you, sir, about Democrats who must now pull this country back from the abyss you have placed us at, when somebody asks you, sir, about the cooked books and faked threats you foisted on a sincere and frightened nation, when somebody asks you, sir, about your gallant, noble, self-abnegating sacrifice of your golf game so as to soothe the families of the war dead, this advice, Mr. Bush, shut the hell up.
Yeah, he goes on for quite a while. Obviously, I skipped through some of that. But again, here, we can see Keith taking the worst possible interpretation of Bush's words. I mean, I am no fan of G.W. Bush by any means, but he was asked directly about golf. He didn't bring it up out of the blue. He was being asked that by the interviewer. And you could respect him. You might even view his response as respectable because he was trying to be forthright about it. It seemed like he was genuinely trying to do something good and sensitive there, even if he arguably came off a little tone deaf. I just wonder, would we have preferred him to lie and deflect about his reasons for not playing golf? I just see this kind of thing around us everywhere, though, this tendency on both, quote, sides to reach for the maximally pessimistic interpretation of everything, large and small. And yeah, I see that as a self-reinforcing cycle of toxicity. You know, where's the empathy? Can't we try to empathize with and understand even people we very much disagree with? I think it's actually a pretty low bar. In the 2008 New Yorker article about Keith that was titled One Angry Man wrote about that. It said the Jeremiad against Bush was a signature Olbermann effort, the sort of stylized mocking tirade that has lately made him a cable news sensation, the Edward R. Murrow of the angry left. Olbermann was pleased with the script, and the next day before going on the air with it, he posted excerpts on the liberal blog Daily Kos, which is a fairly good representation of the Olbermann fan base. The Kosaks wholly approved. You excoriated the bloody-handed, warmongering imbecile. This country cannot survive without you. Dude, you've got a pair of steel ones. I'm going to print it out, hang it up, and memorize it. At MSNBC, the feedback was slightly more cautious. Olbermann's original script identified the, quote, cold-blooded killers as everyone at the Pentagon and in the Bush cabinet. When a colleague noted that that would include such relative moderates as Colin Powell and Defense Secretary Robert Gates, Olbermann modified the line. Phil Griffin, the senior vice president in charge of MSNBC, raised the matter of tone. Why did Olbermann need to end his commentary by telling the president of the United States to, quote, shut the hell up? Because I can't say shut the fuck up. That's why, frankly, Olbermann responded. The line stayed in. So Keith's countdown show on MSNBC ran from 2003 to 2011. As you'd imagine, it included all sorts of incendiary and insulting content and rhetoric, things similar to what we've examined thus far. One thing that stood out to me on watching a few of these segments, he was prone to picking out individual citizens' behaviors and holding them up as significant and worthy of political rage. Here's just one example.
That's ahead, but first time for Countdown's number two story tonight. Tonight's worst persons in the world. The bronze to Greg Howard, 7th grade social studies teacher in the Jackson County School System of Florida. Last Friday, Mr. Howard asked not one but two and possibly three different classes about Barack Obama's call for change and then explained to them by writing it out on the blackboard that change was actually an acronym for Can You Help a N-Word Get Elected? Mr. Howard was given a reprimand, a 10-day suspension without pay. He lost his job coaching football. He was ordered to apologize in writing to each student and was transferred to the county's adult education program. The excuse for not firing him? The racial epithet was not directed at a student.
So, yeah, I see a lot of this around us, this tendency to filter for the badness of our opponents, and then we'll hold these things up as significant even though in a country of 340 million people, there's just no shortage of horrible behaviors of random individuals. or, you know, at least things that can easily be criticized if they're not obviously horrible. So it just begs the question, you know, what do the actions of individuals mean in a country of 340 million people? Are we at risk of blowing up, you know, provoking too much rage based on individuals' actions? Should there be some responsibility to try to put such things in context and to say this was only one person in a large country? To be clear, I'm not saying we can't or shouldn't criticize bad things or that there can't be meaningful trends in behavior. But I do think there's this tendency to filter for these, you know, one-off events, no matter how rare they are, by people on the right and left who build their narratives of the other side's craziness. You know, you can see this a lot in Fox News, you know, conservative media, where they pick out crazy actions of far-left activists and things. Another thing that stood out watching some of those segments of Keith's were just how petty they were. I'll play one here.
That we have a fixed news trifecta tonight. The Bronze, the weekend host Brett Baier and his producers. As he said, the high price of gas may be costing your kids some of their education. We'll explain here. This graphic appeared on the screen. That's right, while trying to blame the Democrats for the price of gas, thus by extension, blaming the Democrats for a negative impact on education, Fox misspelled the word education.
As someone who's worked in TV news and knows how common such things are, it just struck me as so extremely petty for Keith to nitpick lower third misspellings for political points. Is just one of the more petty things I've seen in such a show. I mean, Keith would know more than anyone how common and meaningless those kinds of mistakes are. And one thing this reminded me of when I was going through these is this thing in psychology they call reactance, which is also called persuasive boomerang. Research has found that poor arguments that attempt to persuade someone, if those arguments are poor, that can inadvertently make people go the opposite way and be more committed to their beliefs. So I think that's kind of interesting in terms of like how conflict and more team-based emotions, team-based feelings, make many of us issue a lot of very poor arguments, which in turn can cause anger and which in turn can make people more committed, not less committed, to working against their opponents and their opponents' stances. It can make them double down on their stances. So I think that's just one of many examples of how conflict can be self-reinforcing. Another interesting moment in the Bill O'Reilly versus Keith Olbermann war was in 2006. I'll read a excerpt from that Guardian piece about this. But now a long-running feud between O'Reilly and his less-watched rival Keith Olbermann has boiled over into open warfare between networks. At a meeting of the prestigious Television Critics Association in California, Olbermann, who works for the MSNBC network, donned an O'Reilly mask and gave a Nazi salute, provoking a furious response from Fox's chairman, Roger Ailes. Clearly he has no viewers except those he gets when he attacks Fox News, said Mr. Ailes, a former image consultant for the first President Bush. Olbermann's Nazi gesture, he said, had gone, quote, over the line. The MSNBC presenter has given O'Reilly his Worst Person in the World award no fewer than 15 times and frequently returns with glee to a sexual harassment case the Fox host settled out of court in 2004. And also that Olbermann doing that Nazi salute thing led to a letter of protest from the Anti-Defamation League. Later in 2008, that New Yorker article about Keith included this detail about their feud. Bill O'Reilly made Keith Olbermann, Phil Griffin says. Olbermann concurs, saying, I really do owe him a percentage of my salary. Another interesting moment from the Olbermann backlog was in a GQ interview of Keith in 2013, where Keith talked about being bullied. So I'll read some of that exchange. Was being bullied a formative moment? Well, here's the background to it. I was a big kid for my age and well advanced intellectually, to the point where I was skipped in the first grade. When another kid did not operate at my level of response, Stephen, hey Stephen, Stephen, I'd hit him to get his attention. And my folks enrolled me in a judo class to work out my aggressions. So I was like a potential, bully is too strong a term, it was frustration. I had potential over-aggressive problems. So that was kind of interesting because apparently Keith had claimed before that interview to have been bullied in the past, but when he repeats the details, it sounds more like Keith was bullying other kids. He doesn't mention here any mention of other kids bullying him. So I thought that was just a really interesting tidbit, and I think it says a lot about Keith's perceptions of the world. Was he bullied or was he the bully? Did he maybe just not mention the ways he was bullied in this interview and he was actually bullied? I don't really know, and we probably can't know without more information. It was maybe a combination of both. I don't know. But it does seem like Keith is someone prone to always seeing himself as the victim and excusing his aggressive actions as justified retaliation for other people's perceived harm or disrespect to him. Another thing he said in that interview, he said, "Television is a mental illness. Wanting to be on television is a mental illness. Wanting to be president of the United States, wanting to be an actor, these are degrees of the same mental illness. If you need to be approved of simultaneously by more people that are in this room now, there's a problem. I don't know what would happen if television or fame stopped tomorrow for all the people who are pursuing it, what they would do. I suspect the idea of the zombie apocalypse is based on that." He continues, "I'm going to eat your flesh unless you applaud me." And that's the predicate here of my own self-analysis. But you find yourself at various times in your life being fearful because you don't know how to function in some environment in which you're not being applauded by 1,000 people or more at once. So, yeah, that's just kind of an interesting detail I thought about him looking at the nature of wanting to be television famous. Another interesting thing that stood out to me was a moment from Keith's interview on Charlie Rose in 2014. Keith talked about his obsession with sports when he was a kid. He was extremely into memorizing baseball stats. He collected tons of baseball cards. He talked about annoying his family with his extreme obsession with sports. And then Charlie gets him on the topic of how he sees his sports obsession and interest relating to his political commentary work.
"It's a great training ground in terms of determining cause and effect. You know, a ball game ends and somebody won and somebody lost.
Yeah, I was going to say that. There are always a winner and a loser.
And you can't. You may be able to say at the end of a 120 to 119 basketball loss that it was a moral victory, that you were able to do that well. But you can't go and claim that you won the game. And the reason that I think that almost everybody who goes from sports into politics is, I think it's fair to say, you just don't go and cover politics after you cover sports. You cover it acerbically and doubtfully and dubiously.
Because?
Because there are people claiming that they won the game when they lost.
I see.
Well, that was just a part of that interview, and I think the whole interview was kind of interesting. But I think there are a lot of clues there about what drives Keith so crazy about our political divides. And I mean, I myself am very upset by various things around us, probably in a similar way that Keith is. But I think Keith is someone who very much desires order and clean boundaries, not to psychoanalyze him too much, just based on his words here. We can see that in his obsession with baseball and sports stats, as he talked about being interested in from a young age. And as you talked about here too, he likes the clean boundaries of there being clear winners and losers in sports games, there being clear rules. Obviously, the world of people and politics is much more messy. People behave in team-based and emotional ways. And us being polarized leads people to behave in even more team-based and emotional and unreasonable ways. It leads to people not caring about or even enthusiastically jumping on board the bandwagon of things like Trump's promoting distrust of every election he's been involved in, really. No matter how unreasonable that behavior is, and no matter how potentially damaging to the country it may be. Yeah, so clearly a lot of things about politics are irrational, just as many aspects of the world of people are irrational. It's easy to see how deranging that messy world might be for someone like Keith. It's easy to see how there are real understandable things that can drive him a bit crazy. I mean, like I said, I'm often quite angry and upset about assorted things in the political realm. There are plenty of real and maddening things happening. But I do try to keep in mind that this is what people do. They get entrenched in these toxic cycles of conflict where they act more and more aggressively. They support more polarizing leaders when they're very angry. This is just kind of our thing as people. We have to accept that this is kind of standard for human beings and see that at some level, when we get angry at these things and allow them to mess us up emotionally and intellectually, we have to see that we're at some level just getting angry at fundamental human dynamics and human nature. And that will help us see that how we react to our divides play a role in how our divides play out. So the things that Keith is angry about can lead him down a rabbit hole of just not caring about his own conduct, which I think is what's happened to him, of seeing anything biased or incendiary that he does as minor compared to the horrifying behaviors he sees on the, quote, other side. He doesn't see or doesn't seem to care that there are people on the, quote, other side who are filtering for grievances and reasons to be upset too, who will look at his conduct and be equally maddened and outraged as he is at others' conduct. People will then use that conduct and rhetoric that he takes part in as a way to confirm that people on the left have lost their mind. I'll end with a 2009 piece by Ross Duthat in The Atlantic. Ross made the case for why it was a bad thing for these kinds of approaches to get mainstream political support, as it had with people like Rush Limbaugh among Republicans. The point of calling Rush an entertainer isn't to say that nobody should ever listen to him or care about what he has to say. The point is that by virtue of being an entertainer and having the incentives of an entertainer, he's a poor candidate to fill the role of spokesman and ideological enforcer for the conservative opposition, a role that he seems eager to take on and that Barack Obama is very eager to see him occupy. I don't think Limbaugh is a less serious voice for conservatism than Keith Olbermann is for liberalism, but that's because I don't think either of them should be taken all that seriously, because they're media personalities whose primary loyalty is to their image and their audience, and whose primary purpose is to provoke and get attention. And I think it should go without saying that American liberalism would be in serious, serious trouble if someone like Olbermann were occupying the kind of role on the left of center that Limbaugh seems to be shouldering his way into at the moment. Okay, so it was the end of that snippet from the Atlantic article. If you enjoyed this episode, let me know in the YouTube comments. Consider checking out my books on polarization, which you can learn about at american-anger.com. You can also sign up for a paid subscription to my Substack at diffusingamericananger.substack.com. You can also send me a gift using my Buy Me a Coffee page, buymeacoffee.com/ZachElwood, ZACHELWOOD. I appreciate that because I'm doing my own thing these days, just doing some freelance things and working on toxic divides and such. Okay, thank you for watching. Music by Small Skies.